From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1963 when a six-year-old boy found what he called a forbidden picture in his father's attic. The photo was of, quote, naked, bleached white, skeleton-looking bodies stacked up against a building, end quote. That building was at the Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria. The boy was Thomas Bird, and Bird's father was an army doctor who helped liberate that camp. Thomas Bird followed his father's footsteps and joined the army, and he served in Vietnam and dealt with the effects of that war for decades following it. Bird is now an advocate for veterans. He's a playwright. His latest work is called Bearing Witness, and it explores the connection to war that he and his father shared and the disconnect they also experienced and the effects that the wars had on both of them. We'll talk about the play and about issues facing veterans today. Our guest is playwright Thomas Bird, who is performing his play at the Downstairs Cabaret Theater. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
And thank you for having me.
Every Memorial Day, I struggle with this. Every Veterans Day, I struggle with this. We say Happy Veterans Day, or at least thank you for your service.
I'd like to think that Veterans Day is a happy day.
Yeah, Memorial Day is more of remembrance.
Memorial Day is a day to remember those who died in service of their country, whereas Veterans Day is a celebration of those of us who are still alive, for which we should be, for the most part, very happy.
Well, happy Veterans Day to
thank you.
Thank you for serving, and thank you for coming in and talk about your remarkable work for this hour. I want to kind of go back to that moment at 6 years old for you. Can you kind of take me to that moment a little bit and tell me what happened?
Well, you know, I was already fascinated by my father's service in World War II. I think, of my four other siblings, was the one that just, you know, had that predisposition. And a big part of it for me was to go up and rummage through his World War II duffel bags. And it was for that very reason that the attic was off limits to me, because, you know, I'd go up there, I'd rummage through his World War II duffel bags, you know, just loving to feel the texture of the uniforms and imagine the reality that they once were a part of. And then I'd leave everything out of the bags, and I'd leave a mess behind for someone like my mother to clean up. So I became banished from the attic. But that didn't stop me, and I found ways to sneak up there. And I was always on the search for, you know, something that was hidden, something, you know, old family pictures, old family mementos. I never was searching for what I found that day, which was a pistol, wound up being a .45 caliber pistol, his bronze star with a V device for valor, and this picture in an envelope. The fact that they were hidden underneath sheets and mothballs indicated they weren't something my father was, you know, proud of or gloating about. They were hidden, and, you know, probably only for him to know where they were, not thinking his six-year-old son was going to, you know, rummage around and find them. But it became a defining moment for he and I, because I never forgot that picture, and eventually he started to tell me bits and pieces of what happened in the camp at Mauthausen.
That picture is really interesting to me, Tom, because we're going to talk this hour about your own service,
right,
and what our veterans have experienced and how it can be so difficult to sort of live with it and to internalize it. And in some ways, you wonder, why would anyone keep a picture like that?
Mm.
Maybe you want to remind yourself of just how terrible war and humanity can be, or maybe there are other reasons. But I think there are some who would say, if there were some who were in your father's position, who would have said, I would have never kept a picture like that. Do you wonder about that?
Yeah, I wonder about it. But if I think about myself, you know, I have pictures from the war that I look at on occasion just to remind myself of the reality that it was. And and that becomes a part of the struggle. I was saying that just before is I've done this play a couple of times in Los Angeles, and on a couple of occasions there were Iraq and Afghan veterans in the audience, and they were so moved by the material and especially touched by the fact that, you know, I, uh, a Vietnam veteran who to them is like what my father was to me. You know, we're like World War II veterans to them now because of our age. We're in the majority of their fathers or of their father's age and stuff. They're touched to know that we, Vietnam veterans, still struggle with our memories, but have found a way to move forward in life. And so, you know, those kind of pictures and mementos remind you of something you've been through. They don't hold you back, but they remind you of somewhere you've been, and you know your greater reason for living now is to move forward into life and make the best of the life you've been given.
All right, I'm going to put Tom on the spot because I don't have the schedule in front of me, though I'm sure our friends in the studio can help me with this. His performance is called Bearing Witness at the Downstairs Cabaret Theater, and show dates, times. Do you have it?
Well, okay. I have it in rough. We're on at 8 o'clock tonight, 8 o'clock tomorrow night, and a 2 o'clock matinee on Sunday.
Okay.
Next week's schedule will be Thursday at 7, Friday, Saturday at 8, Sunday matinee. And then the next week, the Thanksgiving week, is Friday, Sunday, Saturday, and 2 on Sunday.
And I know that it on this day, it means even more to have veterans there. Though I'm sure every performance of yours probably connects to veterans in different ways. But on this particular day, does it mean more to you?
It will mean more to me, yeah. I just, you know, bonding with the fellow veterans is always, it's always what it's about. It's always about, you know, bonding with fellow veterans.
When you were 6 years old and you saw that picture, how much did you really understand it?
Not at all.
How long did it take you to really start understanding what was in that image?
Probably not until about nine. Nine was when my father started talking more about what happened in the camps, what happened in the Holocaust. The Holocaust didn't really get identified until much later into... more or less in the 60s, the Holocaust started to take on what we now know as the Holocaust. So in those days, it just was a matter of him talking to me about his World War II experience, and in particular, the Holocaust, in terms of bits and pieces of it. It wasn't an overwhelming experience at that time, but that's when I became aware of a growing denial movement. You know, people denying that the Holocaust happened.
Which probably blew you away, like it just so many people just couldn't believe it.
It more or less, it blew him away.
Oh, yeah.
And in blowing him away, it blew me away.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, that experience had meant, it had traumatized him or moved him more than any other experience he had during the war.
And then to hear this effort to delegitimize, as if it wasn't even a...
It hadn't happened.
Yeah.
You know, and he knew it happened. He'd seen it, smelt it, touched it, and for him to hear that people were denying it happened just infuriated him. But nonetheless, it did happen. It still, you know, there are still people out there denying it to this day, and calling it a big hoax. And it's so cruel. It's so cruel to do that. You know.
The show is at the Downstairs Cabaret Theater, downstairscabaret.com, if you want the full schedule here. And Bearing Witness is written and performed by Thomas Bird in a one-man setting here. How long is the show?
Roughly 80 minutes.
And no intermission?
Minutes, no intermission.
You know, do you feel like you're pouring yourself into this? I mean, it's so personal.
I pour a lot of myself into this. And... to me, it's the nature of the work, you know, to have the courage to reveal yourself through truthful self-expression. To me, that's the nature of the work. That, to me, is what theater's all about. In this particular case, it's my personal story, but I feel that actors in a fictional drama, they bring their craft, they bring themselves to the role, and it's about them using the character to truthfully reveal themselves.
When you talk about your father, again, going to the, did I pronounce it correctly? Mauthausen.
Mauthausen
concentration camp. You've been there, yeah?
Yeah, I visited there in 2006. I'd never thought about going. I had this encounter with Simon Wiesenthal, who's a very was world acclaimed as the Nazi hunter, and he himself was a survivor of the Holocaust. He had actually spent some time at Mauthausen, and I had a meeting with him at HBO. And the head of HBO at the time, Michael Fuchs, knew that my father had been at Mauthausen, so he introduced Wiesenthal and I after a press luncheon HBO held for Wiesenthal because they were premiering a movie about Wiesenthal that weekend. And we had a very exciting, for me, conversation, and it culminated in Wiesenthal suggesting I go visit Mauthausen. And I had never thought about it. You know, it just seemed like I couldn't do that.
Couldn't do it, why?
That was my father's experience. As much as it touched me, going there was not my job, wasn't my life. That was my father's life. There was a little sense of demarcation between his experiences in life and mine. Wiesenthal, by suggesting it, opened a door to the idea that it was okay. And then it just became a matter of affording it. And, you know, as a struggling actor and producer off Broadway, money is always tight. So fortunately, I was bequeathed some money after my godmother died. And I used that money right away to go to Mauthausen, you know.
Wow. And so you had this expectation that you would have that line of demarcation. But when you got there, did it move you differently than you thought?
I've never cried like that in my life. I just cried for 3 days. It just, his stories flooded my conscience, the reality of what happened there. Mauthausen, I'm sure all the other camps embody one thing, which is quiet, silence. And in that silence, you can just feel so much. And, you know, and when, as you tour the grounds and you become aware of what happened in these particular parts of the camp, it just is so, for me, it's just so emotional that I felt like I cried and sobbed for 3 days. And the reality that my father had been there, has been here, walked the same ground, saw these same buildings, etc., just overwhelmed me.
I don't mean to put you on the couch, Tom.
Yeah.
You kind of do that to yourself in the show.
Right.
But the tears that you had, does it come from a place of sorrow that humanity could do this at all? Was it personal about your father and his experience? Can you sort of internalize exactly what moved you so much?
I think it was more of the former, people could do this to other people. Just, it's unbelievable that people could do this to other people and justify it in some way or form. It just was mind-boggling to me. I did go there with a chip on my shoulder. And the chip on my shoulder was Vietnam. And the chip on my shoulder was, Vietnam was the saddest thing I'd ever been through. Witnessing, various war incidences was very sad to me. And I didn't think anything could move me more than they did. And, the reality of what happened at Mauthausen so overwhelmed my Vietnam sadness that I was on a whole new level of sadness. And for the most part, it had to do with how could people do this to other people.
It's also really remarkable when you think about it wasn't that long ago.
No.
We like to think of ourselves as some sort of an enlightened species here.
Right.
We are not far removed from the Holocaust. And it's not like we have a perfect record around the world right now, but the bottom line is sometimes it feels more removed than it is. It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. I'm as a part of my research, I'm in the midst of reading a Pulitzer Prize winning book by Samantha Powers, who's, I think she's at the UN now. Mm-hmm. UN, she our ambassador to the UN.
She has been, yeah.
But she's, you know, she's a fabulously bright woman, and she wrote a book on the history of genocide and documented, you know, mostly America's responses to the various genocides that have occurred, going back to the Armenian genocide, the Khmer Rouge, Cambodian genocide. But one of the things I'm reading recently about the Rwandan genocide, and the biggest pitfall was to use the word genocide. So there's an undersecretary of state talking to a reporter about acts of genocide being committed in Rwanda. It was huge for them to use the word genocide, but they qualified it by saying acts of genocide. So the guy says to the undersecretary of state, "So how many acts does it take for it to become genocide?" And I thought to myself, what a great question, you know. It was obvious to the whole world genocide was being committed in Rwanda, but the State Department, the U.S. government, was minimizing it by calling them acts of genocide. And this guy said, "So how many acts does it take to become genocide?" Yeah. And I read that and laughed. I said, "Right on, man, right on."
George Carlin would say, "It's genocide." Why do we euphemize? Why do we add words to euphemize?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Act of genocide.
Right.
It's a genocide.
Genocide.
Yeah. We're talking to Thomas Bird, who is the writer and performer of Bearing Witness, which is running with a limited engagement now through November 27th at the Downstairs Cabaret Theater. That's on Windsor Street in Rochester, of course. And you can see that show tonight at 8 p.m., tomorrow night 8 p.m., Sundays at 2. So Thursdays at 7, Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 2 through November 27th, and Veterans Day, we thought, was the perfect day to have him here for this. Listeners, especially listeners who are veterans, but if you want to share your thoughts and your own experience of the impact of service, the way it's impacted you in your life, it's 844-295-TALK. If you want to call the program toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Tom's performance is really sort of a his story, his father's story. But he's done a lot of work and thought a lot about helping veterans in this country post-war, post-many wars.
Right.
Tell me about some of the work and some of the effort you've put into trying to really understand and help people.
Well, you know, I'd originally sought to be a actor in New York. And I went through a period, I got you know, great training as an actor from Lee Strasberg, a renowned teacher. And I went out into the acting world and started to audition. And, you know, I never told this to anybody. I went through a period that when I denied that I was a Vietnam veteran, I got work.
Wow.
Because the reputation of Vietnam veterans was so toxic in the acting community that if I said up front I was a Vietnam veteran, people wouldn't hire me. So I wound up denying it and got work. And I said, I can't live a lie. So I started to say to people I was a Vietnam veteran, and they would say, thank you, you know, and they kind of squirm and they would, you know.
Let me kind of dive into this a little bit here, because many times on this program we've talked about the trouble of stigma.
Yeah.
What specifically, was it a concern of PTSD, a concern of can you put your finger on what
PTSD
people
PTSD wasn't diagnosed till the till the 80s. So this is more of a stigma coming from one, the war itself, when the anti-war movement would categorize Vietnam veterans as baby killers, as psychos. The returning veterans were, you know, greeted hostily, because to greet them favorably would be to, for some reason, for some people, would be to, you know, legitimize the war. So we became the pariahs. We were like, a buddy of mine once says, we're like the we're like the rebel soldiers that no one wants to deal with. And then it became a stigma in society vis-a-vis the larger entertainment world. Think of Taxi Driver. Travis Bickle was a Vietnam veteran. On Hollywood shows, you know, Vietnam veterans became, you know, when you needed a bad guy and you ran out of your other quota, you make him a Vietnam veteran, there was, you didn't need to explain anything. They're trouble guys. They've got issues.
So unstable.
Unstable.
Erratic, yeah.
Psychos. All of those stigmas were alive in the population. Mm. And that's what I took umbrage to, and that's when I created a Vietnam Veterans Theater Company. And I still remember the day that we had our first meeting and 40 guys showed up on a Soho building rooftop, and they were all at first whispering, "Vietnam, Vietnam." And I said, "No, you can say it out loud, guys. It's okay." And by the end of this first meeting, guys were screaming off the roof, "Vietnam, Vietnam." I said, "We're going to make it okay. We're going to make it okay for ourselves."
When was that?
In 1977. And we started a theater company, and we started to do theater about Vietnam. As I said earlier, we were doing classic plays to help people come in and see us do well-known playwrights, do the plays well, and develop an audience that way. And we started to make our mark, and people began to understand us and not judge us or stigmatize us. So that was exciting. And then in turn, I always remembered the guys that are forgotten, the vets in hospitals, homeless veterans. So we started programs to reach out to them and let them know at least they're remembered by their fellow veterans. And that's become the lion's share of my work. And the biggest supporter I had, or the biggest encourager I had in that, was my father.
Wow. Well, we're going to get back into his relationship with his father and the complexities there and what they both went through. But let me grab a phone call. This is Joe in Rochester. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, I brought a group of students in 1965 to Mauthausen, and we viewed the memorial there to those who had died. And I just wanted to point out there are others who have left a place like Mauthausen who considered it a hoax. Because in my group of teenagers, there was a 15-year-old who, as we left the camp, we saw the sign, "Arbeit, mach frei," work and you'll get free. Well, and he said, "That's a hoax." Now, his background is that his parents had been dispossessed in Jerusalem in 1948, and they had carried over their hatred to their son, and the hatred was so great that he, living in Brooklyn, was making a bomb in 1964, and the bomb blew up in his basement, and he lost a hand and an eye. And it's just interesting to see the different reactions of people to a tragedy such as Mauthausen.
Wow, thank you. Thank you. I do talk about the memorials in the play because the memorials are a significant part of the Mauthausen experience.
Yes.
Joe, thank you for the phone call. And I think in some ways there's a history lesson for me and for many of our listeners who might not have heard of Mauthausen. And I think there's different layers to what Thomas Byrd has brought with Bearing Witness.
Well, Joe, you're still on the line?
We don't have Joe, but go ahead.
Okay, because there is there's a movie out, but I just recently bought the book and read it. Like I'm a prodigious reader. The trouble is I have like 300 or 400 600-page books going at once.
See, I can't do that, by the way.
This was a book I went through, you know, almost start to finish. Mm-hmm. It's called Denial.
Denial.
And it's about the lawsuit brought by a Holocaust-denying author and celebrity against an American historian, Deborah Lipstadt, who basically denied his denying the Holocaust. Mm. And he in England, you can bring someone to court. You can sue someone in court for defaming them.
Libel, defamation,
yeah,
it's much easier. It's much looser standard.
Much looser standard. Yeah. So he brought her into court and Penguin Books and everything. And there's a movie out now starring Rachel Weisz that tells this story. I have to go see the movie. But, you know, it was challenging to read the book for me because I wanted to know what basis people were using to deny the Holocaust. And it's a very twisted interpretation of history that they use. It's a very flawed historical analytical approach they use to deny the Holocaust. They disregard facts that disprove the facts they're touting and then try to get you to believe that their facts are the facts. And for the most part, this guy, David Irving, was proven to be anti-Semitic. He was out to prove that Hitler was right and proving that Hitler had nothing to do with the Holocaust or genocide against the Jews was a big part of his agenda. And he got unanimously, he lost his case against this British judge who just saw through his arguments and said, you are everything she said you were.
Well, let's get our only break of the hour. I'll come back and reset the conversation with Thomas Bird, who is the author and performer of Bearing Witness, running at the Downstairs Cabaret Theater through November 27th. And on this Veterans Day, we thought it was a timely conversation. Want to explore his service and his father's service and how it impacted them in different ways, their relationship and how that developed. So we'll come back and do that. And just a reminder, on Veterans Day, we're thanking everyone who has served. Dad, if you're listening in Cleveland, on the WXXI mobile app, thank you for your service in Vietnam as well, Tom.
All right.
And anyone else who served, we are so grateful. Let's get that only break of the hour. And John Andrus, I'm going to have to do this live, so we're flying by the seat of our pants on this Friday. So you ready? Let's take our only break of the hour. And I will mention what's coming up on Monday on Connections. In the weeks to come, we're going to be covering different angles of the presidential election. We're going to be hearing from small business owners. We're going to be hearing from different groups of voters who voted in different ways for different reasons. And Monday, we continue those discussions. So policy, demographics, and what we're trying to learn from this election, including media coverage as well. Monday, we continue those at noon. We'll hope you will join us there. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You can see Bearing Witness tonight at 8 p.m. at the Downstairs Cabaret Theater. You have plenty of other chances to see it before it's gone. It runs through November 27th, and the creator of it, this one-man show, Thomas Bird, is here. Where's home for you, by the way? You're in from where?
Well, I grew up on Long Island and, you know, then lived in New York City for 35 years. That's during my New York City theater years. And then I moved to San Francisco 10 years ago to be close to my youngest child. And about a year ago, I moved to Los Angeles. So Los Angeles is home now. As unbelievable as that is for me to say, that's home now.
Why is it unbelievable for you?
Well, I never thought I'd leave New York. You know, and I moved to San Francisco because my youngest child lived there. And she assured me, Daddy, as soon as I graduate from high school, we're going back to New York. So that was my ace in the hole. We were going back to New York. She graduates from high school. I said, so we're going back to New York. She says, no, Dad, I love it here. I love it here. So I stayed.
If I would have told you when you were in your New York City theater days that one day you'd be living in L.A., you would have said baloney.
No, I would have said baloney. But, you know, I knew I had some things to pursue in Los Angeles. I had some things to pursue. They weren't really pursuable in San Francisco. I knew I had friends in Los Angeles, and I thought, I can't go back to New York with these. I'll go to Los Angeles and see what happens with them there. And Bearing Witness is one of the three that's happening.
So when you decided to write a one-man performance here and you had to structure this show, what's the core of the story you wanted to make sure you told with this, Tom?
I wanted to find a way to interweave the experiences I had in my father's World War II experiences, which are in many ways exemplary, and they're historical. And as a kid, they blew me away. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was in awe of my father. And then I had this experience in Vietnam, which for the most part was supposed to be my participation in a good war that was gonna be a victory and, you know, was gonna be a was going to be for me what World War II had been for my father, and it just didn't happen, you know. And I recognized that early on in Vietnam because of some things that occurred that just, you know, seemed to be, they seemed to be things that wouldn't have happened in World War II. I don't know if that was the case, but for me, you know, everything done in World War II was justified. I went through some experiences in Vietnam that I felt weren't justifiable, but nonetheless, they happened. I had to live with them.
Before we kind of dive in there, can I just back up for one moment and say, right. You know, you certainly look at your father's experience and you say, not that anybody is, you know, happy that wars happened, but a more of a triumphant experience, or at least liberating Mauthausen and seeing World War II end the way it did, very different than Vietnam. But your father's experience certainly wasn't perfectly placid. As a doctor, he went through some remarkable things as well. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, you know, as a doctor, he was on the other side of combat. So, you know, when guys get blown up, guys get badly wounded, where are they sent? They're sent to the field hospital. Who takes care of them? Who operates on them? Who amputates their limbs? Who deals with them when they die on the operating table? Who sees the aftermath, the carnage of war? The field surgeons and the medical staff. So that was a lot for him to live with. As I've said a couple of times recently, I volunteered to be an infantryman, and my father dreaded my doing that because most of his patients in the battle with the Japanese, up in the Aleutian Islands, at the Battle of the Bulge, all his patients were infantrymen. He knew not only what they went through in terms of, you know, fighting the war, serving in the war, but the fact that they were his patients and I was one of them really just, you know, it scared him. It scared him near to death.
What did you tell him about your decision?
I just said I had to do it. If I was going to be in a war, I had to fight the war, Dad. You know, I couldn't be in a war and not be in the war. And the only way to be in a war for me was to be in the infantry. I didn't know this at the time. My mother told me years after my father died, she said, you know, during Thanksgiving, your father, the whole year you were away, went to the mailbox 3 or 4 times a day looking for a letter. And then during Thanksgiving, the year I was away, and Christmas during the year I was away, she said he was in bed all the time. He got sick to his stomach. He couldn't function. He was so worried about you. So I didn't know that. And I didn't find out about it till years after he passed away. So, you know, it had that impact on him. He in turn had that impact on me. The difference between Vietnam and World War II was after World War II, the wars were over, the victories were established, and for the most part, the veterans had to catch up with life. So for a lot of them, they put the war behind them and they went forward. For him, he had 4 years of medical practice to make up for. He had 4 years he had to make up for. So for them, the way to get over war was to put it behind you and move on with your life. I came home from Vietnam. The war was still going on and would go on for 10 more years. It was there all the time. It was hard to put away. It was hard to move on from it. And that became a point of tension between us that led to almost irreconcilable, you know, differences. And we had a very hard time together.
You said by the spring of 1978, your father initiated a rapprochement with you about Vietnam. You said you hadn't talked at that point in 2 years.
Yeah, we had 2 years there it just was, I didn't want to talk to him.
But help me understand the source of that tension. Did he disagree with you on any decision? Were you feeling like he couldn't understand? What was the source of that? Because in many ways, Tom, people may assume this is a father and a son serving in different wars, but you would have certain things in common. What pulled you apart?
Well, I had trouble. I was home from Vietnam just a little over a year. I was back in college, and I had trouble with the anti-war movement. I you know, I tried to break up an anti-war demonstration, which I thought was reasonable. The anti-war demonstrators didn't agree with me. Someone called me a war criminal. I wound up assaulting that guy, breaking his jaw, getting arrested, and, you know, being punished for it. And the punishment, instead of jail, was to be put on a very barbaric tranquilizer called Thorazine, and that became the beginning of the separation between my father and I, because not only was I didn't listen to his advice, which was to ignore those people, but I was in trouble with the law, and I was unrecognizable to him, and it slowly became a point of deep. It slowly became a point of separation that grew and grew and grew, and it took a lot of work on his part to bring us back together again.
So, in other words, he comes home from his war. The war is
over.
The war ends.
Over and won.
There's triumph.
Yeah.
There are some parades.
Right.
He dealt with a lot, and again, it wasn't perfectly placid and easy, but it was over. And for you, it was a remarkably different experience.
Yeah, I mean, when the war was declared over in 1973, it wasn't a victory. I was ashamed that we had done what we did in Vietnam. I felt abandoned the Vietnamese who believed in us, and America was celebrating. And then came the 1976 celebration of the 200th anniversary of America, you know. And I remember there was a political cartoon in the New York Post, and it had a big hand holding back the corner of a rug, and there was a broom sweeping Vietnam veterans under the rug. And I thought to myself, that's what they're doing. I mean, you know, the war is over. The anti-war movement got what they wanted, the end of the war. Most of America got what they wanted, was the end of the war. And where does that leave us? Where does that leave Vietnam veterans? And for the most part, you know, it left us swept under the rug. We were, you know, the wars were over. We were forgotten. And life moved on. So when they were celebrating in New York, they had this big tall ship celebration. And New York was like a glow with celebrations. And I'm just like going, what are you celebrating, man? What are you celebrating? That's where I was at the time. And it was very painful to be in America at that time in my life. And it was painful for most of the guys I knew, because we felt forgotten about, we felt betrayed. And, you know, I took that out on my father.
We're going to talk in a moment about how that rapprochement started to happen, but let me grab another phone call. This is Jim in Rochester. Next up. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, good afternoon. Would you guess, I didn't get his name, but obviously he had a lot of experience in Vietnam, consider since you're a playwright, doing a play on Khe Sanh? That was an outpost that the United States military was determined to hold on to, and that happened to it. I'm talking about the United States military at Khe Sanh, as to what happened to the French in 1951 or 52 at Binh Vinh Phu, when they were overran and gave up on the war effort. And technically, from a military standpoint, because of the military muscle, the firepower of the United States military establishment, they won the war, but they lost the political aspect of it, because they dropped a lot of bombs in Vietnam.
Yeah.
A lot of iron, a lot of kinetic energy.
Yeah, they dropped more bombs on Vietnam than they dropped on all of Europe in World War II. In bomb tonnage. There was more bombs dropped on Vietnam than there were dropped on Europe in World War II. And the analogy between the siege of Dien Bien Phu and the siege at Khe Sanh, they're not lost on me. You know, the Viet Minh won the siege at Dien Bien Phu. Our guys were put under a siege. I've heard that it was Westmoreland's way of proving our resolve, and it was a costly way of proving our resolve, because a lot of Marines had to live with daily bombardments and loss of lives, And, you know, you sometimes wonder, what was it for?
What was it for? And I'm told the Viet Cong at that time came very close to piercing the perimeters. I mean, they had outer perimeters, inner perimeters, and that was a major battle.
I mean, when you think about it, the Marines were sitting ducks. For the Viet Cong, and the North Vietnamese to just bombard them day in and day out. God bless all those Marines. But, you know, what was it for?
Would you consider doing something about Da Nang also during the latter part of the war when the Tet Offensive happened in 1968 and the late President Lyndon Johnson sort of threw up his hands and said, that's it. I'm not running for president anymore.
Right. Da Nang was a hot spot, but you know there are a lot of hot spots in Vietnam. But Khe Sanh is really, really a story I think that needs to be told, and I think you've got a good instinct there for a story.
Well, we look forward to seeing your play then.
All right, thank you very much,
Jim. Thank you, and Jim's calling, talking to Thomas Bird, my guest for the hour, the author and performer of the new drama, Bearing Witness, and you can see it tonight at the Downstairs Cabaret Theater at 8 p.m., tomorrow night at Downstairs Cabaret, 8 p.m., Sunday at 2, and then through the 27th of November, it is running Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, downstairscabaret.com for more information on it. Tom, I want to kind of get into this rapprochement, but just to make sure I fully understand, you said that when you served in Vietnam,
right,
you experienced and saw things that you thought shouldn't happen, that they didn't line up with your expectation for what should have been happening there.
And right.
Tell me a little bit more what you mean by that.
Well, I saw, you know, we had an experience where we had a shootout with three enemy soldiers. Two got away. One was wounded and got trapped, and he wound up, he was killed. I killed him. And we wound up exploiting a Buddhist tradition, which is that the Buddhists believe that if a soul doesn't get a proper burial, the soul will wander lost forever. It's very popular tradition in Vietnamese Buddhism. So the South Vietnamese scout that was with us, he felt it was something we should exploit because he felt that the other two may come back for their comrade or others may come along because this was like a tributary of the trails going in and out of Cambodia. So a group of us, a squad of us, set up an ambush around this dead body and waited for others to come back who ostensibly we were going to kill. I just couldn't imagine American soldiers in World War II wasting their time on this. You know, this, you know, Vietnam was about body counts. And I thought, are we that desperate for body counts that we're going to set up an ambush around this guy's body? But sure enough, you know, we did. I was one of those that was a part of the ambush. And we waited 2 days for others to come back, and nobody came back. And, you know, subsequent to that, you know, many, many years later, I learned that what we did were their violations of the rules of conduct of war. You know, not that it doesn't happen all the time, but for me personally, because I had the experience of killing this young boy, I took it very personally that what we did was considered a war crime by the Catholic Church and Geneva Accords. That's, for me, at 19, raised Catholic, that was very hard to live with. And the fact that I also compared it to World War II, and I didn't think anything like this would happen in World War II, was really hard to live with.
Were you able to talk about that with anyone, your father or anyone else?
Years later, I talked about it with some of the guys who were with me in the ambush. And they understand that it had an impact on me, that it didn't have on them, but they in turn recognized how insane it was what we were doing. When I eventually talked to my father about it, he was furious. He was furious that the United States Army would do something as for him, it was as stupid as set up an ambush around a dead body.
Did that contribute to the divide between you?
No, that became a part of the healing between us. I was able to talk to him about it, and he was able to empathize with me. Prior to that, he didn't want to hear anything from me. Hmm. His edict was put the war behind you and get on with your life. And I took him at his word, and I tried to do that. And as it backfired repeatedly, all it did was make me angry at him, because I was trying to do what he told me to do. And, you know, this needs maybe be put into a therapeutic context or something, but, you know, that's how I was. You know, you told me to go to the war. Now you're telling me not to talk about the war. And all this stuff is coming up from the war. Well, I can't talk to you about it because you don't want to hear about it. There's nobody to talk to about it. So I'll live with it and I'll get angry about it. And I got angrier and angrier and angrier.
What's the main reason you were able to resolve that divide?
Because he listened. The day that we had an rapprochement, he told me some things I didn't want to hear. And I lashed back at him with my take on what he didn't want to hear. And that led to the unveiling of some things that I did in Vietnam that he listened to and he was very moved by. And that began the process of him and I bonding about our wars, which until then were on separate tracks, growing wider and wider and wider apart in distance.
As we get close to the end of the hour here, Tom, I would love for you to just share with the audience why you wanted to write Bearing Witness to begin with. Was it for you and sort of internally? Was it for other veterans? Was it for people who are not veterans to understand?
Initially, it was, I had such, I even in the days where I was separate from my father, we weren't talking, I was angry with him. I always had great reverence for him, as a World War II veteran and for the experiences he went through. That was unquestioned. It was the more personal dynamic between us that caused the trouble. So when I went to Mauthausen, a suggestion was made by a friend of mine who is a New York Times journalist that I explore writing a memoir about going to Mauthausen to bear witness to my father's time there and write it as a memoir of a Vietnam veteran, a World War II veteran, and going to Mauthausen to bear witness to my father. And out of that, as I said earlier, the pain I felt from Vietnam and the sadness I felt from Vietnam started to come up. And what came up were a couple of different incidences in the war, which I had still had a lot of sadness for. And, you know, as I explored writing at Mauthausen, I started to write about them. I hadn't planned on it, but I started to write about them. And eventually they started to fade, and what happened at Mauthausen took over. And that led to my coming back to an experience of my father's that he had at Mauthausen, which stayed with him until his dying days. It was so traumatic for him. That really is the healing piece. That's the closure in the piece, is him revealing secrets about World War II that he had kept hidden and locked in for years. Hmm.
The show is Bearing Witness, and you can see it at the Downstairs Cabaret Theater. And on this Veterans Day, I couldn't imagine a better way to end the week, just learning from your stories and your experiences. I want to thank you for being here, and I just want to ask you to kind of wrap up here. I think about my dad, and he doesn't really talk about his service experience. I mean, everybody is different. We talked to World War II service members, and they experienced very trying things. And on this program, they talked about things they hadn't talked about in decades.
Right.
Everyone's different in terms of how they internalize. What would you want to share in our last minute of the show? What would you want to share with people who are not veterans but have veterans in the family about how, you know, sort of how to embrace and talk about and help the veterans among us?
Now you got. I think the first thing is you've got to be open to listen. And you know, listening to a veteran who's troubled or listening to a veteran who just has a story to tell you is a huge step for the veteran, and you've got to be willing to do that. You know, for me, bearing witness to Vietnam and bearing witness to my father is a very personal journey, and sometimes good things come out of the most personal, and that's what I'm hoping for that experience. And for anyone out there with a veteran in the family, you know, be a friend, be a listener, be open to them, you know.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that image of sweeping Vietnam under the rug ever existed. But I hope that you hear thank you for your service.
All right.
And I'll say it. And thank you for your time here as well.
And thank you for having me. I really appreciate you taking the time to have me here. Thank you.
You got it. And happy Veterans Day to Tom and to everyone who has served. And thank you so much for that. Bearing witness to the Downstairs Cabaret Theater tonight and through the 27th. John Andrus is the engineer of this broadcast. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. It has been a long week, hasn't it? And let's continue these conversations on Monday. Until then, have a wonderful weekend.